And hello, everyone, and welcome to this panel. This panel is called Security and Privacy Challenges in Health Informatics. So today we have all sorts of data being collected about ourselves, and often these data are uploaded and stored on cloud providers. Especially with the trend of mobile and wearable computing, like we have our mobile devices, our Fitbits, and other types of sensors collecting our biometrics data. And so privacy becomes an important challenge. How can we protect such data? In particular, most of us would agree that medical and genomic data are particularly sensitive. For example, for genomic data, everyone has very unique genomic data. And once leaked, the data will be leaked forever. It's not like, you know, you can go and change your genomic data or something. Okay, so on the other hand, there is a great demand for data-driven medical and genomic research. And these data-driven approaches promise many exciting applications, such as new drugs, maybe new personalized medicine, and genomic compatibility testing, and so on and so forth. So this panel will focus on how we can achieve both privacy and utility and functionality at the same time. We have three distinguished panelists. So let me first introduce the panelists. And David Kotz, there, is the Champion International Professor in the Department of Computer Science at Dartmouth College. He currently serves as the Associate Dean of the Faculty for the Sciences, and previously he served as the Executive Director of the Institute for Security Technology Studies for 4 years. In 2013, he was appointed by the GAO to the US Healthcare IT Policy Committee. His research interests include security and privacy, pervasive computing for healthcare, and wireless networks. He has published over 100 refereed journal and conference papers and obtained over $15 million in grant funding. He is the PI of a $10 million grant from the NSF Secure and Trustworthy Cyberspace Program and leads a 5-university team investigating trustworthy health and wellness technology. Okay, and we also have Professor Xiaofeng Wang. Professor Xiaofeng Wang is an associate professor in the School of Informatics and Computing at Indiana University, Bloomington. He received his PhD from Carnegie Mellon University in 2004, and since then he has been a faculty at IU. And Dr. Wang is a recognized active researcher on system and network security. His work focuses on cloud and mobile security and data privacy. And he is the recipient of multiple awards, including a 2014 CSOAR Best Paper Award in Applied Cybersecurity Research, a 2011 award for Outstanding Research in Privacy Enhancing Technology, also known as the PET Award. And also the Best Practical Paper Award at the IEEE Security and Privacy Conference, also known as the Oakland Conference. His work frequently receives attention from the media, including CNN, MSNBC, Slashdot, and so on and so forth. His research is supported by the NIH, NSF, Department of Homeland Security, the Air Force, and Microsoft Research. He is the director of the Center for Security Informatics at IU. Okay, and finally we have Dr. Xiaoqian Zhang. He is an assistant professor in the Department of Biomedical Informatics at UC San Diego. His research interests includes healthcare privacy. Okay, so to begin with, each panelist will give a very short presentation to kick off our discussion. So we'll begin with Xiaoqian.
Thanks for the opportunity to participate in this panel. So my name is Xiaoqian Jiang. I'm going to talk about some privacy challenges in biomedical informatics. So as we match into the realm of big data, biomedicine is also moving into the data-driven approaches to practice personalized medicine. More and more individual data being collected. EHR, which is widely accepted and adopted in clinics, serves as the basic to practice clinical personalized medicine. And there's additional data like personal genomic becoming increasingly available due to the reduced sequencing price. Actually, there's more than 60 genetic variants are currently adapted in clinical practices. And family history data is acknowledged as one of the best genetic tests ever available. There are also additional sources of useful information like pharmacogenomic data being considered and to serve at the base of personalized medicine. And there's a lot of big data networks are being established over the country. Recently, the PScanner Clinical Data Research Network, funded by the Patient-Centered Outcome Research Institute, as part of the PicoNet, is trying to aggregate more than 21 million patient records all over the country. And the goal is to serve as Kawasaki disease, congestive heart failure, and obesity groups to conduct nationwide research. There's also clinical data network like the UC Rex, which tries to aggregate information over the five medical schools at UC and their affiliated institutions to cover more than 12 million patient data. And the goal is to improve patient safety, surveillance, quality improvement, and support translational research. There's also data networks try to bridge across the borders. For example, one of the National Center of Biomedical Computing called IDESH, hosted at UC San Diego, one of its driving biology project is to study the GWAS of Kawasaki disease. You know, the Kawasaki disease is a rare disease in the United States, so there's a limited sample that we can obtain, in, for example, in San Diego area. So the goal here is to try to get information from countries like UK, Singapore, and then try to build a bigger cohort and to get more robust statistics. However, there's challenges to build these models across the country. For example, UK does not allow their patient data to be hosted outside of EU. So naturally, these big data networks are operated in a federated mode because you don't have a centralized database collecting data from everywhere. You can imagine there's frameworks like a horizontally distributed data exist in different institutions which has similar patient have always similar attributes, want to study some global effect or interventions. And each institute do not want to share their patient level data, but they want to compute a global model. There's also vertically distributed frameworks. For example, like sequencing data are hosted at a sequencing center, and the clinical data are hosted at local clinics. And there's also insurance companies. Each party want to collaborate, but they do not like to share the raw data with others. There's also unique characteristics in the medical world that we also have consented data. So some of the patients are willing to donate their data, like donate blood or donate money for research. So in addition to the private data, we also have reference data that can be used to promote the protection of these private data while achieving better utility. So, potential solutions can be secure multi-party computing, differential privacy, homomorphic encryption. But the question here is how practical this approach in real clinical applications and how scalable these approaches are. What is the utility and the privacy challenges and the trade-offs? So when we have big data, we have more opportunities, but at the same time, it brings bigger challenges. As we all know that if we want to share the data in their raw format, we need to go through a tedious institutional policy like IIB, Internal Revenue Board approval. If this is cross-institutional, it's a very tedious process. And there's also tiered informed consent being more popular, saying that we should grant the patient the right of the data access. So patient can allow you to use their data for one study, but not for the other. So we need to acknowledge all these fine-grained details when we do the studies. And also, if we want to share the data across data networks, the privacy rules such as HIPAA privacy rules should apply. And the protected health information include genomic data, because genomic data, you can imagine that is a kind of biometric. And the early paper by Lin and Altman shows that as long as 72 SNPs are revealed, you can uniquely identify a single person. And even the statistics are not safe, as Homers and others indicated in the later paper. And for these high-dimensional paper, protection is a big challenge. And I think Dr. Wang will give you more details in his talk. And the sequential data release over the time will also cause a collateral damage if you didn't budget the privacy well. So data and the computing outsourcing, if you think about NIH is thinking about exporting dbGaP to a public cloud. How can we ensure the privacy of this information while enable a scalable and affordable computing? And additional challenges include mining unstructured clinical narratives along with the structured data. So actually, there's a various vulnerability in the lifespan of clinical data that needs rigorous protection. At the stage of data collection, we need to protect its storage. And if we want to share the data for certain utility, or we want to disseminate data to the public given such a function, then we need to protect its computation in a distributed manner. In the end, when we compute in a model, we want to share the result, we need to protect its output. So as the NCBC in UCSD, we try to evaluate these solutions and try to assess the performance of state-of-art method in terms of the real applications. Last year, we conducted a challenge which focused on differential privacy genomic data analysis in collaboration with Indiana University. We launched two tasks. The first task is privacy-preserving SNP data sharing. The second one is to access privacy-preserving release of the top K most significant SNPs. And this workshop is well attended, including two NIH officers, and we also broadcast the entire workshop live and publish the output of the challenge in a special issue of BMC. So this year, we would like to shift our focus to data outsourcing and secure data analysis in a distributed setting. And welcome to visit our website, humangenomicprivacy.org. And we are focusing on two tasks. The first one is homomorphic encryption-based secure genomic data analysis. And the second task is multi-party computing-based secure data computing. So finally, I want to acknowledge the following grants to support our research. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Xiaoqian.
I'm going to talk about, you know, just the interesting privacy research from genomic area. And, you know, just I myself is a computer scientist and security researcher for many years. But I found the genomic research, biomedical research intriguing. And I'm going to show you how interesting the things is. And, you know, just we are all witnesses, you know, just you know, the revolutionary progress on genomic technology, right? You know, the price for whole DNA sequencing keeps going down. Today, you know, just back 14 years ago, the first human genome, whole genome, was sequenced at a cost of $3 billion. And until last year, And we hit this $1,000 mark. You know, Illumina has this machine which can, you know, just can sequence the whole genome at extremely low cost. Today, if you want to, if all you need to know is 1 million variation across your genome, right? And the cost even lower. You can get the whole things, you know, just by ancestry.com or 23andMe at a cost as low as $200, even lower. And with such so much, you know, just at a low cost genomic data available, right? You know, just and what has been unleashed is great potential to use these new kinds of information assets. And genomic data naturally can be used for healthcare, can be used to identify your susceptibility to a certain kind of genetic disease. And for a certain kind of disease, just like cancer, you know, just genetic therapy could be the only hope. And also biomedical researchers, they're aggressively looking at the genotype or phenotype mappings, trying to identify and genetic markers for a certain disease. And there are legal forensic application of genomic data. And increasingly people use, you know, just your DNA data for ancestry test, for paternity test. But with all these opportunities come with security and privacy risk. And if you are your genetic weakness having no one to the unauthorized party, you know, just and it's gonna be very problematic, right? So there's genetic discrimination. Someone may say that I don't care about privacy, you know, just I just want to make my own data publicly available, right? But I don't know whether you indeed have the right to do so. Because once you publish your own genetic data, you know, just and it has been shown in the security community, it is possible, you know, just I can look at your DNA to infer the genetic weakness of your kids, of your parents, your sibling. So it's less clear whether you indeed have a right to make your own data publicly available. And the privacy issue of genomic data has been well recognized. And back 2 years ago, their presidential commission and studied these issues, and they have a bunch of suggestions. And they need to, for example, you know, just hold those data owner accountable, and the data needs to be properly anonymized. And they need to have a good practice for security privacy. And but all these things at a high level, they make a lot of sense. But and when it comes to detail, there are a lot of technical challenge. And for more information, you're welcome to look at our survey paper, one of the first in this kind, you know, just give it publicly available online, have a lot of information. And let's talk about technical challenge a little bit. And for dissemination, if you want to disseminate your data, if you want to anonymize your data, but still keep its, you know, utility, and this turned out to be very difficult. Why? Because genomic data, they are of extremely high dimension. Even you aggregate thousands of people DNA together, re-identification can still happen. And second, you know, just genomic computing is truly big data analytic. To see the scale of the problem, here let me give an example. This is a DNA sequencer. Suppose you give your blood sample to a sequencer, and all it can generate is a large number of short sequences, each with 100 to 120 nucleotides. Each short sequence called read. Those single reads do not make any sense. You cannot interpret it. To make use of it, you need to find out its right location. So the whole thing is just like solving a puzzle. You need to put each piece back to its right location. The simplest way to do it is called read mapping. You have this reference genome, right? You pick up one read and find out the right position along this 6 billion chain, such that the read and its counterpart on the reference genome looks very similar. Their added distance is below certain threshold. But as you can see here, to find out the right location even for one read takes a lot of computation. We are talking about, you know, just 10 billion at the very least. We talk about a million upon billion added this computation. So if you want to do this thing in the encrypted form, you're using homomorphic encryption on EC2, you can imagine the scale of the problem. Right. And, just as I mentioned, the data, genomic data, you simply release the anonymized data and want to preserve its utility, it can be very difficult. It's extremely high dimension, although there's some connection between different SNP, we call linkage disequilibrium. And this information has not been fully understood. And also there are a lot of, you know, reference data, you know, just there are a bunch of people, thousands of people, they don't care about their privacy. They have their genomic data published online. Randomly pick up 2% in this room, 99.9% of your DNA identical. So those references can be used for re-identification. It had been shown back 6 years ago, right? Homer come up with this attack, re-identify individual from DNA pool, cause a lot of trouble. NIH indeed removed all this data from public domain. Then later we show, yes, you can remove those aggregate data, but you still need to publish a paper, right? There are research, bioinformatics research, biomedical research. But whenever you publish a paper looking at research outcomes, we can do reverse engineer. We can identify your raw DNA data. We can even re-identify patients who participate in the study. And the work turns out to be very difficult. Even do a simple classification, identify data set that you can safely release is NP-hard. And we have a few results. If you're interested, you can look at our paper. So the most interesting thing is just like Xiaoqian mentioned. And we want to understand what the state of art, how far away the current security techniques are in terms of supporting, you know, practical protection of human genomic data. So that's the whole purpose. So we have this community challenge, and which organized by, you know, NIH IDESH Center and together with multiple organizations. NIH is extremely, extremely interested in the outcome of these things. And so our work has been, this competition has been reported by Genome Web, which is a portal for the, you know, just the biomedical and genomic research. If you're doing research in this area, you look at this website. And last year's competition is on data anonymization. And just like Xiaoqian mentioned, we have these two tasks. One is protect read raw data. The second, protect the outcome of analysis. And five universities participated in the competition. And Austin won the competition. And you know, just and the result is both positive and negative. And we show if you want to anonymize raw data and protect to the standard of differential privacy, it's almost impossible. As long as the sequence goes above, let's see, you know, just 300 nucleotide, you cannot get both privacy and utility. And but the second thing is, if you are willing to give your algorithm to NIH Center to do computation, and they will give you the, you know, result with some noise added to that, to protect the outcome to the level of differential privacy, then, you know, just and both, you know, just and looks, there are a lot of promising there. And both CME Austin's algorithm, they can scale to 100,000, you know, just nucleotide. And the result, although it has been perturbed by noise, 90% of the results are accurate. So I'm extremely interested in this kind of result. So this year, we want to do something different. They want to see if secure computation can help them. They want to put encrypted data on the EC2 and to do analysis there. And so they're intrigued by homomorphic encryption, secure two-party computation. And we have a real task. We have a real data there. We have a virtual machine. So, you know, just if you want to have your work have a real-world impact, please participate. You know, download the VM and put your algorithm there. Submit your code. We will do analysis. You know, just and so if you want to see more, get more information, go to this website, humangenomeprivacy.org, very easy to remember. And I have to acknowledge my NIH R01 grant and the recent support from NSF.
Okay, yes, thanks, Xiaofeng. So this genome privacy challenge is really exciting. I have one quick question, like, do you have some prize award for the prize money for the challenge?
This is hard, but not the last year, Vitaly actually big up, you know, just some, you know, just a kind of award recognition for NIH, right?
Right,
and
so
I think they took a pride in that.
Right, so yeah, I have my students send their program to the challenge. Right. So,
thank you.
I know a lot of you guys are working on like secure computation and fully homomorphic encryption, computation on encrypted data. I think this is a great opportunity to put these research to test.
The prize was the winner's genome gets posted on the web for seems like an appropriate free hosting of your genome. So actually, I'm shifting gears a little bit. I'm not talking about genomics. I'm talking about mobile health or mHealth, as is often called. And actually, I've seen it defined in many different ways. And so this is the way I think about it, which is actually still pretty broad. It's the use of mobile computing and communications technology either for the delivery of healthcare or for collecting health-related information, such as in epidemiology. So you see mHealth in the clinical setting. The use of mobile devices is increasingly common in healthcare clinics, tablets and smartphones and specialized devices. In particular, you're seeing it both in the hands of the clinician, as in the previous slide, and somehow used directly with or on the patient, monitoring the patient in the clinical setting. Of course, a lot of traditionally inpatient monitoring was done with wired devices and so forth. Increasingly, that's done with wearable or mobile devices that attach to the patient and allow the patient to move about more easily. And of course, remote patient monitoring. Send the patient home with some devices that they can use to monitor their symptoms or their treatment and hopefully help the clinical team remotely to monitor the condition of the patient and be alerted when problems occur or when the patient is not complying with their medication regime or something like that. And of course, the big sort of most obvious aspect of mHealth is in the consumer space, particularly around fitness applications, but more generally around wellness applications, devices that you can buy and use yourself for staying fit, losing weight, stopping smoking, standing up straight, you know, all kinds of devices like that are coming out almost literally every day. And then another prominent place where mobile health is being used is in the developing world, the use of mobile computing and communications technologies to help improve the scalability of severely under-resourced healthcare systems or to support research and access by people in rural areas that don't have as much access to healthcare as they might need. And all of this is enabled, of course, by the increasing prevalence of mobile computing technology, in particular smartphones. The smartphones themselves are a wonderful mobile computer, but they also have a surprising array of sensing devices built into them. This slide is actually old, and there are actually, in some cases, more sensors built into modern smartphones than even these, such as fingerprint sensors, gyroscopes, things like heart rate sensors, et cetera. And then there are a lot of devices that are emerging, like I said, literally almost one every day. This being the week of CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, I'm sure we're going to see a lot more devices being released this week. Some of them are wearable, including an uncountable number of fitness bands now, but some of them are more clinically oriented, such as the heart patch that you see in the center of this picture. And they tend to be used to sense all kinds of behavioral or activity or physiological parameters that are used either for consumer purposes or clinical purposes. And not just, of course, wearables, but also occasional use devices such as a scale that you might step on once or twice a day, a blood pressure monitor you might apply to yourself once or twice a day, or sometimes devices that sit in the environment and provide information that's relevant, such as dust information of use to people with allergies or temperature and humidity that might be important context in understanding other physiological data. All of this combined produces sort of a body area network, if you will, of sensing devices that can, and actuators increasingly, that can monitor your health or your activity or your behavior and provide that information into algorithms that can help you or your clinical staff or your family to better understand what's going on with your health and to better help you manage your health condition, whether that be a chronic disease or simply a wellness-oriented goal. In the context of mHealth, there are, of course, a huge variety of security and privacy issues that come up that are different in many ways than what you might see in traditional healthcare, like electronic health records, or in the context of mobile but not health type of applications. The security implications can be more profound because there can be direct, immediate consequences on the victim, if you will, of a security-related attack on a mobile health system. Some of these devices include actuators, such as insulin pumps, and if there's an attack on that device, that can cause the device to malfunction or inappropriately dose you or change your heart pacing in a pacemaker, and obviously that can have severe consequences. Or even those that have no actuator but just collect information, if that information is used to make a decision by yourself or your family or a clinician, then an attack on that data can affect your health. Of course, a range of privacy issues. A lot of medical conditions or behavioral conditions are very personal, very sensitive, not something you want to share with just anyone. And so the data that is being collected here is very, very literally about you, maybe much more sensitive than your web browsing habits or your social network data. the volume of data can be huge. You know, you go to, you see your doctor once or twice a year, and they collect your blood pressure once, they collect your weight, they collect some other parameters. The amount of data collected in your clinical visits is dwarfed by what you might collect in a wearable continuous monitoring situation. So there's a tremendous amount of data. And the diversity of data can be much broader than you, what, again, you would think of in the traditional clinical context, because you're collecting data outside the clinical setting in many of these cases about your lifestyle, where you go, who you meet, how active you are socially or sexually or what have you. And that information is highly diverse. And of course, there are many more uses of data than the traditional clinical healthcare type setting. Outside the doctor-patient relationship, there are wellness-related applications and behavioral health, behavioral modification types of applications. So in so you can see there's a lot of privacy issues. And a few years ago, we published a survey paper in ACM Computing Surveys about privacy in mobile health. And if you're interested in digging into much more detail about the privacy issues, the scenarios, the threat models, a privacy framework, and some research challenges, many of which are still wide open, dig up this paper from 2012. And in general, I just wanted to thank my colleagues in the Trustworthy Health and Wellness Program, or thaw.org. If you're interested in our ongoing work in this area, please check out our blog and our site. This is funded by NSF SATSI. And that's all I have. I know we're anxious for interesting questions.
Thanks a lot, David. These are very exciting efforts. We'll now open up the floor for questions. So if you guys have any questions that you want to discuss with the panelists, please line up at the microphone. Okay, to begin with, I have a question about the potential deployment path, right? So basically, security and privacy technology, they all come at a price. Do you think for the medical and genomic domain, who do you think will be paying for the security and privacy? And do you think legislation will be the main driving force for deployment? Or do you think maybe this will maybe, for instance, open new markets?
So, you know, just this is a very good question and a very, very challenging question. Right? You know, just I don't know the, I'm not sure I know all the answers, but, you know, historically, let's be honest, we are all security researchers, but let's be honest, historically, no one cares about security. No one cares about security in the first place, right? You know, just, I always talking to other people, you know, just if you have a $1 million, you know, just and for build up a staff, how much money you want to put on security? Tiny little amount, right? You just want to sell the product. But the security is a kind of thing, so just like a trap. You don't care about these things at the very beginning, but later on, you know, just and when you become successful, then, you know, just you're looking at the whole things. It becomes, you know, just and you'll start worrying about security. So I think the genomic could be the similar things, you know, just at the very beginning, you know, just and people don't worry about security too much, security privacy too much. But later on, you know, people see the, you know, just the bad things happen and start worrying about these things. And the consumer will be aware of this risk and will be careful about these things. And by the way, you know, for genomic data, there already, you know, just some legal framework. For example, there's a law which is called GINA, right? Mm-hmm. And it is... It's called Genetic, and I forget the name. It's Non-Discrimination Act. The law is very rough. It cannot be, you know, effectively enforced. And also importantly, you know, just it does not apply to life insurance. It does not apply to military. So there's still discrimination there. But you know, just and people start walking toward this direction. And you know, just in the presidential report. Actually, you know, just one of the important action items they identified is they want to raise the awareness of genomic privacy and for the public. So, you know, just the legislation and the people are doing some things. And I think those biobank, those company, they are also start worrying about these things, right? You know, just and I think, you know, just the effort will come from government, from private industry, and from the consumer ourselves, right? You know, just and from different perspective.
I think it depends on the application. In the clinical context, there are regulations already, such as HIPAA and HITECH, that affect the security and privacy mechanisms that need to be put into place around these data. And in the context of medical devices, which now includes certain classes of apps on smartphones, there's the FDA and its process for certifying the safety and efficacy of the devices. And the FDA is increasingly aware of cybersecurity-related issues, in part because of Kevin Fu's tenure there last year, raising awareness of those issues and helping the whole community to better understand those. So regulation is one driving force that will enhance the use of security and privacy technologies in these broader technologies, and the market is the other. And so one example is Apple in its new HealthKit software SDK and its new health app on the smartphones and eventually the Apple Watch has decreed certain boundaries of what is acceptable and allowable by the apps that use HealthKit, for example, not storing the data in Apple's iCloud. And so there, I think that is Apple making a market statement saying that we think we will have a competitive advantage by making sure that our ecosystem is more secure and more privacy sensitive than other ecosystems. And so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, but they are spending some money and forcing their developers to spend some effort on security and privacy.
Yeah, I also agree that in the medical world, the regulation is enforced. So if you have just a small number of cases leaked, you have to report, and that often costs the hospital to be fined for millions and the employees to be dismissed. And this can be a huge reputation problem. So there are definitely incentives in the healthcare system to protect privacy and security.
Maybe David?
So one of the things that I think makes this problem particularly hard is it's very unclear what can be inferred that might be sensitive from much of this medical data. And the natural thing as a paranoid privacy person to say, well, we don't know what can be inferred, so we better keep it all private and give up all the potential medical benefits of sharing it. The other solution is to say, well, let's look at what can be inferred today from the genome and be careful not to expose sensitive things through that, but share everything else. Neither of those seems like the right answer, and I'm wondering if any of you can have thoughts on this or suggest what the right answer is in terms of deciding what is actually sensitive given what improvements there might be and what we can infer from this data in the future.
Actually, I think this is a very big question, right? You know, just I don't think I can give it a full answer today. But you know, just and I think in NIH, you know, on bioethical community, they have this kind of trend, you know, just and because they are not very technical savvy, right? On one hand, they think, genomic data should make it public, you know, just and to facilitate research. On the other hand, when the bad things happen, they think, you know, they should hide this data. You know, just otherwise, you know, just if you leak it out, it leak it out. The data will not change, right? You know, just and the consequence will be very serious. And so they have these all kinds of concern, informed consent, you know, even open consent, not just that agreement that basically give away your privacy at all. So one thing I'm thinking about is, you know, just the problem cannot be solved by technical person alone. And also, obviously, cannot tech solved by those bioethical person alone. So there should be a conversation between these two ends to come up with a better way to move forward. So I have some wild idea I talked to then, you know, just it's very premature. For example, maybe, you know, just in the ethical community, they don't have this idea about adversary model. Right, it's you know just maybe we can introduce using layman's term. I'm not talking about adversary model, right? You know, just and we expand this thing to patient. No, I understand, but something like that under a certain kind of well-defined circumstances, and using technique means we can offer some privacy guarantee. Beyond that, we cannot protect. And the thing is, we acknowledge the fact that in general these things are very difficult to protect. On the other hand, we force the data owner practitioner to do their due diligence, to enforce the best technique possible to protect patients' data. Right, you know, just in general, I think this is a very interesting direction and need a lot of effort from a lot of, you know, just the different parties.
Thanks. Well, thank you all very much, David. I sort of can, by the way, my name is Jerzy Rosenblatt. I'm with the University of Arizona, and I sort of have a question for David. Your work resonates very much with me because I work on the intersection of medicine and engineering. And clearly the two examples of the insulin pump and the pacemaker really life-critical applications. So whereas the emphasis has always been on the safety and class 3 category implantable device, I think that it's only now that people are realizing that the security of such devices is paramount. So perhaps I'll go back to the regulation issue. Will it take, you know, a huge lawsuit or perhaps some political will to push the manufacturers to be much more cognizant of the security issues with devices that are clearly life critical? What are your thoughts on this?
That's a really good question. And actually, both of those examples, those devices, the pacemaker and the insulin pump, have both been publicly hacked. Exactly. Not in the wild, thankfully, but by demonstration by researchers. And those demonstrations have opened a lot of eyes and raised a lot of eyebrows and has caused the industry, I think, to become much more aware of the potential issues. And so although the FDA has certainly been paying more attention to cybersecurity, I think it's been a broader community effort. I'm not directly involved in that. Kevin Fu is sort of the academic face of that effort, and he was here yesterday, but not today. And for example, Kevin runs a workshop every year called Archimedes, which brings together the whole or a large fraction of the biomedical device community to talk about these kinds of issues. And so I think we're moving in the right direction in terms of awareness translating into action. How quickly it will resolve into improving the cybersecurity of these devices is not clear to me. I know that it's a big concern, and the range of devices is huge, right? From the implantables to the desktop devices to the room-sized devices in hospitals. And I talked to CISOs in hospitals, and they have literally tens of thousands of devices that they have to manage. And one of their challenges is managing the cybersecurity of these increasingly networked devices that are on their, have an IP address on their network and are getting bombarded by malware. And a lot of them are running, you know, Windows 98 or something like that, and they are unpatchable or difficult to patch or change. And so there is a need for both the manufacturers to improve the sort of core security. There's also a huge need for third-party products to help CISOs and their teams to manage fleets of these devices in clinical settings. So there's a lot of interesting research around that. And then as these devices go home with patients or people who aren't technical, who don't have a sysadmin in their home to configure the device and make sure it's configured securely, that issue becomes even more challenging, I think, because usability is a major factor. So I don't have any answers for you except to say that there's a lot of work to be done and I encourage people to engage.
Yeah, I would like to say, you know, a few sentences about these things. And increasingly, I'm going to say, you know, just and the phone manufacturer, you know, just they will have the device manufacturer, they will have the incentive to, you know, just address security privacy issue. And, you know, just a few years ago, if we look at, you know, those customized phone, right, you know, just the things are crazy, right? You know, just looking, and we also did a lot of work on the you know, just the mobile smartphone security, you know, just looking at their Linux layer, a lot of critical devices actually made public, right? You know, just you have a permission, it's completely fake. If you have a native code, you can directly touch the, you know, just and a camera driver, take a picture without the permission. But now they treat things more and more seriously, you know, just and for example, and we are in conversation with some phone manufacturer, look, because we discovered this you know, just those mobile device, mobile phone, right? You know, just and they are designed fundamentally cannot support, you know, just critical, you know, just application, just like a medical device. For example, if you connect this phone with the, you know, just and the Bluetooth glucose meter, for example, right? And the only things Android knows is whether this app has Bluetooth permission or not. So any app has Bluetooth permission, entitled to connect to this external device, even it's a malicious app. And make it worse, that the malicious app can even unpair your device with glucose meter and pair it with, you know, just an attack device. And these things is, this medical application on top of Android actually is beyond Android's protection, right? You know, just, and so these things come out at the very beginning, no one cared, but later on, you know, just the phone manufacturer, we have a communication with phone manufacturer, we have a defense technology, you know, just they are interested. But just not to the extent, and so far, still not to the extent to somehow affect their, just a deployment, right? To them, utility always come first. But under this constraint, they are willing to consider more about the security and the privacy protection. I think in general, people think security and privacy is important in the medical device, in the healthcare device, and Internet of Things. And people are moving on to the right direction.
I just want to add one more thing. We just had a workshop last month, November, led by Carl Landwehr of this community and the Thaw Project, and that was called. It was an effort to make a building code for building code, and his analogy is that we have for architectural structures building codes, standards and things to which buildings must meet, homes and hotels. And he says, well, why don't we have such a code for writing software, building code? And he gathered a group of medical device engineers and other software engineers and interested parties in New Orleans and started a draft of such a code. And they've released their report a few weeks ago, and now it appears that some of the attendees who are very interested are going to carry this forward and try to push it into the standards processes. So there's hope that there will be more structured mechanisms for designing and building software for medical devices that will have, among other things, security as a factor.
This is sort of a follow-up or a complementary question to the last. So in the commercial world, probably the best we can say is that when we try really hard, we're not completely incompetent all the time at defending against sort of generic attacks, but we've never been able to build economically viable defenses against targeted attacks. And so I'd like you to comment on the evolution of the threat models in this area so that we can better understand the kinds of challenges we need to adapt ourselves to in this area.
So when you say in this area, are you thinking of mobile?
Yeah, the mobile in particular. David.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a tough challenge. I guess... my impression is that we are still addressing a lot of the low-hanging fruit. Some of the general challenges, such as was just mentioned, the lack of Bluetooth protection of access to Bluetooth devices by the operating system, that's still a very general purpose or general kind of attack that we have yet to address, at least in Android. And the targeted attacks that would be specific to a particular type of application or specific type of device may not be necessary when you have such large holes. Mm-hmm. And so the threat models, at least as I'm seeing them, have yet to need to evolve to the more specific attacks. Mm-hmm. That said, thinking off the top of my head, for the implantables, they tend to be very, very specific approaches that are needed, very unique to that particular device. Attacking specific vulnerabilities in their radio protocols. So I suppose what we need is some general principles for designing and testing and verifying or validating these systems and devices so that they meet the properties that we want them to have. I like to try to think through the set of security properties, the goals you have for the system, the adversary model that seems reasonable given the likely attacks, and at least among my students, have them design a system to meet those goals given those adversary capabilities. And I'm not sure how common that way of thinking is in the sort of general engineering community. Maybe you know more about that than I do. In academic research, we think that way. Is it common in engineering to think that way? Maybe in your group it is.
Yeah,
because you're a security group, but
yeah.
I hope it is. Maybe we need to teach that to all of our students.
Yeah, we'd like every engineer to think that way, but it's not quite there yet.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, just personally, I think a target attack is very difficult, right? But in general, you know, just looking at the whole situation, the security situation is terrible. Let me put it this way, and we don't even need to worry about target attack. You know, just the attack need some, you know, just attack itself need some target. That's the weakness of vulnerability of the system, right? You look at the mobile device, full of the loophole. You know, just and not only implementation problem, and in many cases it's completely design problem. You know, just and for example, and you know, just I myself, you know, just and talk to a lot of people about the fundamental design issue of Android, possible iOS, it's a closed source, but you know, just and they do have this issue. Android is not designed to support a lot of things.
Right.
Yet people still put on top of it. You know, just and why we use this phone? What is phone used for? Use it to make a call, to play Angry Bird, and to send a message, right? But it's not designed for bank transaction. It's not designed, unfortunately, for healthcare. It's not designed for, let's say, you know, just and for home security. You know, people are doing crazy things. So click a button, and the kids are standing in front of the door. Click a button, open the door. Click a button, close the door. You know, when you do these things, and we have a couple of papers before on these issues, an app, malicious app, without any permission, zero permission, they know precisely when you open the door, when your kid is standing in front of your door. You know, just the Android design is not for defend against this threat. Yet people are still using it. Fundamental issue is there's a gap between how, you know, just what Android and iOS, those mobile OS are designed for, and how people are using those systems. And those application developers, the only thing in their mind is I can use a phone to do these things. They don't know if the operating system can securely support this functionality. You know, just this Bluetooth, you know, connection is just one example on Android. You know, just and the only thing it can do is give an app Bluetooth permission or not. It cannot connect a specific external device to a specific app. They cannot do this binding. They only can bind a device to a phone. So if you have a malicious app on your phone, also have Bluetooth permission, then you know, just screwed, right? Another example, SMS. Any app with SMS permission, right? You know, just if you use bank, you know, just and if your bank send your transaction information through SMS, the app with SMS permission can read it. It's only not designed for this purpose. I think, you know, just to solve this problem is challenging, you know, just because operating system designer, they cannot predict how people are gonna use their device, their system, right? They need to be evolutionary systems. And when new application come out, you're looking at the security demand for those applications, automatically adjust your security supply to meet this demand. And I think the whole thing is a challenge. That's my personal opinion.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, yeah.
Karen Chang from Purdue. Emma, I'm a nurse. I'm very interested about using mobile technology to promote quality care, including not the provider, also patient or anybody. So my, very interesting by talking in this conference, I found out lots of people are afraid of using personal health record electronically. They think it's not secure. Or not only that, they were thinking about people will sell your data. So I think some of you addressed about security issue. And also there's a lot of things. How can you win the trust of people they study about privacy and security? So far, I have not met, met very few people in this conference either aware of my personal health record or are using my personal health record. So what's your view of promoting this in the future?
So are you referring to a specific product or company called My Personal Health Record?
I'm not promoting anything, but my research is related to Epic's MyChart.
Oh, okay, so the concept of a personal health record.
Yes.
Yeah. I've certainly heard of it, and I know of some that have come and gone in the marketplace. I don't see them as inherently insecure. You know, it's possible to build a personal health record, I think, that has the kind of security properties one would want. And it's possible to build one that doesn't sell your information. But I would be concerned as a consumer about whether I could make an informed determination about a given provider of a PHR, whether their privacy policies or business practices were something I could trust. To me, that would be difficult to discern. A lot of the PHRs that are operated right now are, like the one I think you mentioned, are part of an EHR.
Correct.
And are offered by a hospital or other provider.
Correct.
Who's running an EHR and is offering a portal, basically, for the patient. And those I would tend to trust more because they're operated by a HIPAA-covered entity who is presumably, following the kinds of practices one would hope that a hospital would follow. They're not perfect. There are breaches every year. I guess I haven't used one myself.
Good.
I think my provider has one. I just haven't used it.
It's very convenient. I'm just hoping from a user perspective, I hope, again, this is a collaborative effort. I hope engineering or computer science people can really develop a system so the user don't have to worry about security issues.
Oh, I absolutely agree. No, I think it's an important challenge. And the usability is a really big part of that. It needs to be usable by the everyday consumer so that they don't have to think much about this, and yet they can still get access to their own data and not make security-related mistakes that would spill that data. And a lot of it comes back a bit to what David was asking about, which is, okay, I can log in and see my data, that's great, but I might want to share some of that data with another provider or with my family member or caretaker or something like that. And the really interesting question to me is, how do you help the consumer, the patient, the person, make those choices in an informed way? I want to share this data with that recipient, a different set of data with that recipient, a different set of data with that recipient. I want to understand before I make those decisions, what am I sharing and what might they infer from what I'm sharing? And I have yet to see a really clean and general way of helping people do that.
Right now, actually, just a quick one. My personal health record, the one I'm using, if I log in and I'm travel abroad, another country, another state, I can log in and show my provider if I get sick. I don't need to share with, say, ask so-and-so to log in to access my chart. I can just log in and show my chart. So it's really convenient. I think individualized patient-centered care or user-centered care is the way to go in the future.
And
all the technology you're talking about can link to in the near future, should be able to link to the personal health record.
And the provider will believe you when you show them your chart?
It is something you don't manipulate that data. You cannot manipulate data. Because, for example, my lab results, everything is pushed from EHR to my chart. So I can see my last several years, blood sugar, lipids, vital signs, whatever.
Right, in principle, that's right. Although I know everyone in this room probably realizes there are ways that could be manipulated, but you know, roughly speaking, yes.
Something to add on. Actually, there's a motivation to move toward personal control of your own data. So tiered informed consent is to allow you to grant access of certain attribute to certain study. So given a clinical trial, people can contact you whether you would like to participate, and you can grant certain attributes that you feel comfortable to be shared. And there's ongoing research in our department that trying to build a national registry of tiered informed consent. See, we trust most of the healthcare institutes as honest brokers, but they just need to know who are the targeted patients are willing to participate and what are the attributes that can use. I mean, instead of looking at the local registry that are available in the clinical or the hospital, then if there's a national registry of such access and grants, then we can look them up and form the study much easily. Comparing to the traditional way of doing open consent, you sign a form and give up all the right, you have your own access to your data.
This is a little bit of a policy question, I suspect, but I've been working with a small company that its CEO is also a lawyer. And let me just give you the punchline of his analysis, and that is that in a world in the United States where malpractice claims are as they are, that you as an individual will not have a medical record, but every provider you have touched will keep an original of their version because to protect themselves against the circumstance of a malpractice suit later, they're not going to say, here's a pointer into a cloud where I looked before. They're going to say, I have a copy of it. And so the proliferation of subcomponents of your overall medical record will be substantial based on the very fact that the doctor, to protect himself, has to have whatever it was he used to make his decision with at the time. I compare that, if I may, to the CDC principle, our public health law in all 50 states, where if I check into the hospital with one of a small list of diseases, like if I have Chagas or the bubonic plague or typhoid, my privacy goes away and the records get shared broadly because that's the way public health law works, because it's a communicable disease. I'm wondering if you wanted to comment in the world coming forward that you're part of, what policy might we make for disclosures by parties who, in some sense, had a right of access? How would I ever know that one of my doctors was invaded and everything in his file cabinet, if you want to call it that, was taken? And how would I compare that to other circumstances where Department of Health, in a given state, for example, might say to all the doctors, I want to see anybody who's got this genetic component because the following things. I just think we have a wealth of who has what record and what rights they have that is not going to be, I have a medical record for me, but it's going to be my medical record is the synchronized sum of all of these others, some of which I have different rights with to others. That's not well formed, but I wondered if you were thinking about it.
Yeah, it's certainly the case that your medical record, if you could imagine it, is already scattered across tens or maybe hundreds of places that you might have.
And let's assume that will accelerate.
Yeah, and that's always been the case. It's just that they've been on paper for the most part, and now they're increasingly electronic. And that's because they're the business records of the businesses that have served mm-hmm. you. And it's understandable that they have their own copy. And so the question is whether you should also have a copy, and whether you should, as an individual, be able to coalesce or aggregate that information in a personal health record in the cloud or somewhere, or whether a federated model might allow you to do, you or your provider, to do a search and find all the parts that are relevant to you nationwide or worldwide, neither of which have been, for both technical and policy reasons, achieved, although certainly proposed. And there's a huge range of complications there, some of which you mentioned, not to mention, of course, 50 states, 50 different state laws having to do with the different access challenges.
I just wonder whether there's a way to, while we still have a little bit of flexibility, talk about policy issues that can be implemented in technology and those that can't. Because I fear that our friends in the policy sector roughly believe technology is magic. If you order some, you'll get it.
Yeah, some do. But I think there is a fair number of enlightened people who understand both worlds well enough and recognize the complexity of actually implementing policy, especially in these large, distributed, multi-organization legacy systems. There has been a lot of work done. A lot of reports have been written about, we should be doing more of this. There was a great, there's a report that came out last year whose name I'm spacing, from the Federal Science Advisory Group. That was proposing basically a nationwide healthcare sort of information system and some ideas about how it should be constructed. And that has spurred a lot of policy discussion about what would be the policies that would need to happen to make that work. So some of those conversations are underway, slowly. Some other countries are actually way ahead of the U.S. in that regard.
I'm not going to prolong that. I just think that the complexity will, and the speed will defeat probity in this space.
One interesting sidebar to that is the question of identity and identity management.
Sure.
So in order to aggregate records about you, we have to understand who you are and match your record in one provider with your record
Absolutely.
In another. Absolutely. And as you know, as we all know, I suppose, names are not unique and not sufficient. And so identity is a major factor in
No, the $200 genome test will solve that.
Maybe that would. Maybe that would, yeah.
Yeah, question generated by the last question, actually. Has work been done where the communities have talked to each other on provenance, because, for example, maybe you can't solve the some of the technical problems right away, but you can at least put markers in so you know what doctor, what provider got the record when, what they did with it, and so you can create a trail later. Can you comment on that?
I don't have any specific report on whether that's been done or how that could be done, but Latanya mentioned that yesterday, in effect. She suggested that it would be useful if there was a way to trace the flow of your data through this big web of paths that it already flows through, and to be able to know then if there was a breach, as Dan was alluding to, if there was a breach, was my data there and involved in that breach? Because I can know that my data did or didn't go there. I think that's actually a wonderful problem to look at, both from the provenance point of view. In other words, if I'm a doctor looking at a piece of data, where did this come from and how much should I trust it? And from the other direction, where did my data go and how much should I be questioning their right to have my data? I don't think there's a solution for this, and certainly not one that's implemented.
And for this kind, I think these things is highly related to accountability issues, right? You know, just and you have a security protection. It's always, you know, competition on multiple things. You know, just you have access control to prevent unauthorized party from getting access to data in the first place. Then, you know, just and for some insiders, they do have a legitimate reason to get access to the data, but they may abuse their, their privilege. So accountability is another tool we can use. But in general, these things are very difficult. Right? You know, just for example, the GINA Act I just mentioned, this genomic, non-discrimination act, it's already there. But these things are very difficult to enforce, right? You disallow people to discriminate another person because this guy's genetic profile. But how do you know this discrimination ever happened? Right, I think it's a long-standing, a problem, in the security community, and in how to effectively enforce policy. So I think to solve this problem, we need a bunch of people, technical people, biomedical people, health practitioner, policy people, work together, and talk to each other and see if what kind of policy can be enforced, what policy cannot be enforced, what policy can only be probabilistically enforced. Right, and to build up kind of deterrence, for those malicious activity, right? You do something bad, you may not get caught, but with some chance, long zero chance, I can capture you. Once I capture you, you will be in big, big trouble.
Any other questions? I have another question. So we have a lot of traditional generic security privacy technologies, like let's say generic access control, maybe generic secure multiparty computation, generic secure storage technologies. So for the medical genomic space, do you see this as just putting these standard technologies together, are there unique challenges for the medical genomic space? And if there are unique challenges, what do you think is the biggest distinguisher that makes medical genomic data different from standard security technologies?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question. I think that, personally, I think the major challenge here is the scale of the problem. It's a big data computation, right? You can do already, some computation technique, just like SMC. Right, already work very fast, but you can compare at a distance, with 100, 200 units. But I'm talking about million upon billion, at a distance computation, right? I still think that if you want to work on this type of problem, it's still extremely challenging. But on the other hand, you cannot do at a distance. That not means. The existing technique you use this, right? You still can do Hamming distance. Even you address the Hamming distance problems, it's already a big step forward, right? They need at a distance, but your Hamming distance already can do a lot of things. So, that's what we are trying to find out, in our competition. Use your best technique. We want to understand what can be solved practically what still cannot be solved. And you know, just also will provide some information to the security community, to the crypto community, to the applied crypto community, and then let you know that's the practical demand from bioinformatics, biomedical community, right? You know, just when you're developing your new technique, and take those consideration into your mind. You know, build up something people will use.
Besides the scalability, there's also policy issues. For example, we build a grid logistic regression model that can calculate a logistic regression model by locally calculating covariance and gradient over different hospital to be shared. A model works okay in like UC system, but in VA, it requires a human approval of every bit being sent out. So there must be a human in the loop. And the algorithm needs iterations in an automatic manner. So this doesn't work well. And also, a lot of time, this internal policies requires you do not install third-party software, you cannot open certain port, and there's a lot of restrictions that doesn't match the current standard technology.
If I can broaden your question beyond genomic data to health data, and at least in the context of access control, I think the answer is no. You can't just apply traditional methods for access control to healthcare information systems. Even just thinking about EHRs, electronic health record systems, the kinds of policies that are expressible in traditional access control as computer scientists think of it don't map to the real world problems and workflows in hospitals, both because they just weren't designed for that kind of setting and also because the way people use those systems in real life just doesn't map well with the kinds. So for example, you know, the most sophisticated access control systems, for example, role-based access control, it sounds like a great fit, right? Doctors have this role, nurses have that role, nurse practitioners have that role, billing technicians have that role. Give them access rights according to their role. In fact, that's probably the common textbook example. But it doesn't work because very quickly there become dozens or hundreds of roles and people have multiple roles at different times. And sometimes a person is actually both a patient and a staff person. And sometimes they have different roles in the organization as well. Plus, in medical contexts, you also need emergency access to records. So you don't want to have to sit down and try to get at somebody's allergy information or current medications when they are coding on the table and have it say access denied because you forgot your password or you don't have the right permissions because you're not their doctor. And so all EHRs allow you, everyone, to have access to every patient, basically. And then they go with accountability. So they have a break glass system. As a policy-related issue, there are laws around the sharing of certain kinds of sensitive information related to mental health and behavioral health. If you are referred to a behavioral health clinic, for example, for drug abuse, and then they send the records back to the hospital, then the hospital cannot reshare those records with anyone in the hospital. They have to control it, and they can't reshare them with another provider. So if I go to you as my doctor, and I tell you all this information about my drug abuse and so forth, and I consent to allow you to share that with others, you can do so. But if you receive that information from an outside party, you can't share it with others until you reconsent me. So these laws and policies are not expressible in today's traditional sort of computer science-y access control. And they raise new kinds of questions. And you need to track where you got the data from because it affects who can have access to it.
I see. Yeah, thanks. And so let me ask one final question. So I guess this is also like a classic question whenever it comes to security and privacy. Like, do you guys think we are on a winning battle? Like, what defines success? Are we aiming to solve, let's say, software vulnerability and stop data breaches? Are we aiming for something else? Like, where do we want to be? And like, when can you say, you know, we are successful in addressing the security and privacy challenges?
I think that's an ever-going battle. Because no matter what we do, there's new source of data, new source of application. We never imagine that 3 billion of whole genome sequence data 10 years ago being under $1,000, and brings a whole lot of challenges to the community by integrating genomic data to EHR, to mobile health, and continuous publishing of this data also creates new challenges, because you can never know like how much protection you need to reserve for future release. And I think we are trying to lift the bar to prevent normal attackers, but there's always new attack models being proposed. That's why we need to apply the advanced protection mechanism and evaluate how successful they are, and this will keep always.
I think I completely agree with Xiaoqian, and all the security, we've been in this community for many years. What we've done here, look at, all the paper published, all the technique we proposed. We're just trying to raise the bar, we raise the bar step by step. And particularly when new application, new technique just come into being, new information assets shows up, just like genomic data. We really don't understand, we don't understand what's the potential of using these things. And we don't know how people are going to use these things in the future. And of course, we have a little idea about, what will be the new security challenge and the new security risk. And so the whole thing just like a moving target. And we see the problem, it's already there. We were trying to do our best to protect the patients, to protect data owner, and without undermining the utility of the data. But we acknowledge, a lot of things we cannot do. Along the way, new things will show up, new challenges will show up. We keep monitoring, and we keep doing what we can. So security, I always talk to my students, it's such a good profession. And you will never lose your job.
I'm afraid we're not very optimistic up here, except in the full employment of this room full of people, I suppose. I agree that, but on the other hand, there's a great opportunity right now. There's a huge expansion in the use of technology in healthcare, broadly defined, genomics, mobile, EHRs, et cetera. And so I think, now is the time that we should be engaging with these developers and providers and so forth to help them develop the systems with security in mind and privacy in mind, so that 10 years from now we don't say, oh, darn it, I really wish we had thought about privacy when we did all this genomics, or I wish we'd thought about security when we put 10 million people's electronic health records into electronic form. And so I'm optimistic in the sense that it's exciting to be involved. I don't think it'll be easy to solve. I don't think for both practical and policy and technical reasons, there are a lot of challenges. But I'm ready to work. So,
if I'm allowed to add a few comments, on one hand, I share Darius, optimism about the whole things. But on the other hand, I think, just to build up something, if we do something security by construction, security by design, we can do our best. But this is hard, right? And one ultimate constraint is, we cannot predict how does this evolve. We cannot predict how people are going to use this information. We cannot predict, you build up this Android. I think maybe back many years ago, I still remember the Android designer and travel to all the conference to give it a talk to show up their, application sandbox, which is a good design. But still, we have a lot of loopholes, because I guess at that time, with the build-up system, they never thought about people can use this tiny device to support a medical application. They can use this tiny little device to support home security, right? And because application evolve, it quickly go beyond what a system can protect. So it's more like a chasing target. Designer cannot predict how system will be used. So these things are always there. Of course, I'm not saying we can do nothing about it. I think it's $1 million questions, and people need to think about how to build a system which can evolve, can quickly, provide more security functionality to meet the security demand, right? Of course, security comes with some cost. You need to do these things carefully, and itself is a big research question.
Just $1 million?
Well, I would want to amplify the fact that, as we heard yesterday repeatedly, I think a lot of the security risks or threats come from people and their interaction with the technology. And so It's not just a technical problem, and it's not just a technical solution. A lot of these issues can only be resolved through a combination of technology and policy and user human understanding of the people using these systems, whether the patients or the clinicians or what have you. So this is why it's great that SATSI is a cross-division program and that we have so many social scientists here.
So excellent points.
I agree.
Okay, so yeah, let's thank the panelists again. Thank you very much for your participation in this panel.